Hello and welcome to Lost in Science for another week. I hope you're ready for us. We have 30 minutes of incredible science coming in to your eardrums so shortly. My name is Claire, and with me on the show this week, I have Lyndon.
Hello.
I have Chris.
Hi there.
And I have Stu.
Yeah, I'm here too.
Well, it's great to have the whole gang together.
A complete set, huzzah.
A complete set. We are going to dazzle and tickle the eardrums of our listeners today with Lindo, do you have a ticklish story?
Ooh, is it a ticklish story? Maybe not. I think if I was to tickle you with this story, you wouldn't move because it's a story about death.
Oh, so it's a sad story.
Is it a sad? It's a mystery, I think. Oh, it's okay. It's a mystery.
Good
about...
mysteries start with a dead body.
Yes. And this story's got a few dead bodies in it. How old are they? They're quite old. How did they get there? That's the mystery. How did they get there and what do they mean for the evolution of rituals, for the evolution of caring about loved ones who have passed on? That's the story that I've got today. So, no, it's not ticklish.
It's not ticklish, but it'll get you thinking about bones.
Yeah, sure. It's bony.
It's bony.
It's bony.
It's bony.
Yeah.
A mystery from history.
Oh, yeah.
Mystery from history.
Good one.
And Chris, a mystery from history for you?
Yeah, okay, mystery. Well, sort of, I suppose, yeah. I'm also looking at evolution, something that may be a bit more, I guess, horrifying than dead bodies. slugs.
Oh, now you're speaking my language.
Yeah, yeah. It started from a question from a four-year-old about slugs. Got me thinking about evolution, about convergent evolution, in fact, which I will go into some details. But it got me on a long path that covered crabs, it covered anteaters. Yeah, I'm going all over the shop.
You are all over the animal kingdom on that convergent evolution,
exactly.
Just where you should be. Well, okay, I'm going to rename this show The Evolution Show.
Yep.
And let's get on with it.
Welcome back. You're listening to Lost in Science. My name is Lyndon, and it's funny, isn't it, how human beings do so many things to honour, celebrate, commemorate certain occasions, right? We blow spit all over a bunch of candles when it's our birthday. We have different countries around the world have all sorts of crazy rituals to bring in.
Songs, for example?
Yes, to bring in the new year. You know, some countries you have to eat a bunch of grapes. Other countries spend millions of dollars on fireworks. There's lots of different things that we do to commemorate big events. And then, of course, there's our celebration of life when somebody's life ends. Yeah, we have a big funeral. We honour that person. We think about all the things that they've done and we bury them. Yeah. This is something that I really took for granted until I came across a study recently. It's not just one study. It's a bit of a saga, actually. A little bit of a, a dramatic scientific debate going on about the evolution of burying the dead.
So in humans?
In humans. In early hominids.
Right, okay. Because right? Like I could say, they have other animals also grieve and, like, you know, some of your corvids are seen to have to have big gatherings when
what's a corvid? Let me expose my ignorance.
Crows and ravens and those sort of things.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
The spooky birds.
Spooky birds.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that checks aligns, out. Doesn't it? Mm. Yes. Mm. And chimpanzees as well, you know, they will really pay certain attention to when a particular member of the family has died. You know, they'll play with their hair and play with their nails and teeth and those kinds of things. But some of the earliest records of Neanderthals kind of having a ritual or burying their dead is about 75,000 years ago.
Oh, okay.
But there's this other area of research and a few other different research groups that have been looking at much, much earlier potential evidence, and it's potential because it's been knocked back repeatedly in the scientific literature, for evidence of very early hominids. So I'm talking about Homo naledi here. Naledi? I don't know if anybody's heard
that
of
that. That were the ones that were found in that
cave.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
South Africa?
Yep, they were found in the Rising Star Cave in South Africa. So in the Rising Star Cave in South Africa, these guys were around about a quarter of a million years ago. So they would have overlapped with Homo sapiens, but they had a brain about a third of the size of ours, quite small, and they were shorter as well. They were only about 144 centimetres. And in this Rising Star Cave in South Africa, there is a lot of bones. There are a lot of bones of young examples of this. Would you call it a species?
Species.
That this group of researchers in South Africa have been arguing for quite a long time represents a burial, represents a place where the communities have gone to bury their dead, which you might think, oh, okay, like, yeah, righto then. But if you think about it, if a community or if a species is honouring their dead in that way, they put the bones or they put the bodies in a special place or they've put the bodies in a monumental kind of location, then that means that they don't just see these extra people as extra hands. They really are seeing them as kind of individuals and somebody that needs to be kind of honoured. So this research group tried a few years ago, they pulled all this evidence together to say, yep, we reckon this is a burial site. You know, it's very hard to get to. The lead researcher, he had to lose like 25 kilos to wiggle his way into the cave to actually a look at what was going on. And, yeah, so they tried to submit this research quite a few years ago and it was knocked back. All four reviewers who reviewed the paper said, nah, there's not enough there.
What was the reason? It was just not enough evidence.
Just
for
not
them.
Enough evidence. Yeah, they
it
couldn't.
It was that big a claim that they just didn't.
Yeah,
think that
this
was
claim
enough.
Was that it was deliberate sort of burying or deliberate care of these passed away.
And was there
species.
Any evidence of disease or anything like that?
There wasn't any evidence that I could see, but then you couldn't rule it out.
Yeah,
really. You know, it wasn't as if they had all died very quickly. I don't think it could be attributed to any kind of natural event like a volcano or anything like that. One of the arguments that was put forward was that, no, this isn't a burial site. This is just a group of dumb young men who like have risk-taking characteristics and they've all gone into this cave and made the same mistake.
And couldn't get out.
And they've all sort of been stuck in this cave.
Were they quite small, the Homo naledi?
They were about 144 centimetres, shorter than us on average.
So they would have had easier time getting into the cave if the cave was similar to what it is today, I suppose.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But they also found in the cave some quite clear markings. Very hard rock would have been really hard to scratch and it had been deliberately scratched, which kind of strengthened the argument. So I think it was earlier this year, the same group of researchers made a stronger case, and it was accepted and it was published. And in fact, two of the researchers who reviewed it earlier reviewed it again and one of them changed their minds, which is actually pretty rare. Like it doesn't happen that often. And I think it's quite an interesting thing to consider, right, how these species evolved to think about themselves not as as packs, but as kind of individuals, you know. Mm. There is another similar cave up in Spain that also has bodies, and I think there are other structures or other locations around the world that have bodies that appear to have been buried, not quite as old as this one, but appear to have been buried with some care. So they're either near a big particular rock, or they're in a very special place, or they've been buried with flowers, for example, which some researchers say this is evidence for a ritual taking place, but others will say, well, no, they've just kind of covered it with some leaves and that's not really a ritual. That's just kind of something that is going on. And then there are other bodies that have been found where you can see that first aid has been applied to that body. So they've taken care of a person once they've injured themselves, which is another indication that these societies and these communities have evolved to kind of have...
Yeah, there's this care element.
Exactly. There's a care element. There is a respect for the individual. And then there is respect for the people kind of as themselves. You also see this a lot if there are quite young bodies as well, bodies of babies and kids, which can be another indication that the society is changing. And I don't know, this is a really fascinating drama that's kind of playing out in real time. How early did societies or early species start to work as a community or to care for each other in a human way? You know, did this species take on these ideas because they were interacting with Homo sapiens at the same time? Was it an example of evolution of ritual?
Cultural evolution.
And I don't know, will this scientific argument end up resolving itself? Maybe not, you know. Researchers just tend to kind of like to keep arguing and stick to their own guns for a long time. But
and certainly with like human evolution, particularly cultural evolution, there's always a lot of argument and, you know, things changing all the time and new ideas and this kind of stuff. So
yeah, it's definitely, even though it was a very long time ago, something to keep watching.
Mm.
Science, novel and innovative concepts occasionally arise from sudden left-field inspiration.
Nothing shocks me. I'm a scientist.
But I'd rather be remembered for my own small contributions to science.
As a scientist, I don't want to prejudice my experiment. I'll let you know in the morning.
I am a scientist!
I think they're scientists.
I bring scientists. You bring a rock star.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, you are listening to Lost in Science.
All right, yes, you're listening to Lost in Science. My name is Chris, and recently one of my four-year-olds, yes, reminder, we do have twins, that's not important to this story, made the comment that slugs are just snails that have lost their shells.
I mean, Never a truer word has been spoken.
The wisdom of four-year-olds.
Well, I wanted to fact check it, I've got to say. I didn't want to agree on my head. Now, let's be honest, we're talking a small child here, so quite possibly he meant it literally, as in
they have misplaced it somewhere. They're literally
a snail that lost a shell. But yeah. I wanted to know, evolutionary speaking, is this true? I needed to check this. I figured it was probably true, but I had to check. And of course it is true, as you could probably have guessed.
There you go. Where are the four-year-olds running this show?
But so there, it's not the other way around, which could also be the other option, is that
which came first?
And that's the thing. I want to find out which came first. Now, it turns out that slugs and snails, they are both mollusks. Mm-hmm. That also includes things like, you know, squids and octopuses and that sort of stuff, but also, you know, oysters and clams and this kind of stuff. Now, the exact evolutionary origins are uncertain because we're going back into like the early times and things, and we're talking like a lot of soft-bodied creatures. But it is generally believed to evolve from like a snail-like creature over 540 million years ago that had a shell. Okay?
Right.
So the shells came first. And if you look at even things like, so, you know, with go to the your octopus side, your cephalopods, those sort of things, got cuttlefish have that kind of nice little cuddle. They kind of lost their shell. The octopuses have kind of lost their shell, but there's kind of a hereditary thing there.
Right. And similar situation with the nautilus?
Yeah,
nautilus that's actually got the shell?
Yes. Yeah, there's various creatures that have shells. Now, slugs actually do. Most slugs have a vestigial shell that's usually inside their body.
Oh,
so there's kind of, and there's also things called semi-slugs, which have kind of like a little, they're hooers and a half shell, let's call it that. But yeah, so slugs have basically lost their external shell. Now, this is the thing, guys. I was trying to look up about slugs and this kind of stuff, and it was really difficult to look up their family tree because slugs are actually disgusting. I was trying to work out, what are the slugs that we see around, you know, our backyard? And it's like, I don't want to have to look at them closely enough to figure that out.
I 100% empathise with that. There's no animal that I hate more than a slug.
What about sea slugs? Sea slugs are great.
Yeah, but slugs on the bottom of your feet when you don't wear your shoes outside.
Oh, yeah.
That's what I was going to say. A sea slug's not likely to be crawling across your kitchen floor when you've got no shoes on. So that's why slugs get the bad name.
But this is all relevant because apparently the disgustingness, the slime and all that kind of yucky stuff is part of their defensive mechanism caused by not having a shell. So they have to defend themselves because they don't have a shell, and that's why they do it by being revolting.
Yeah, but surely they evolved to not have a shell, so it must have been beneficial for them.
For some reason, they lost their shell, yeah.
They could squeeze under fences easier without the shell, so they got rid of them.
So snails don't have as much sort of like mucus and slime as slugs.
No, slugs are slimier. But yeah, no, someone mentioned sea slugs. Now, this is where we get into this concept that when you look at their family tree, you find that there are various orders. Like, classification is tricky and it changes all the time, but there are various orders that have both snails and slugs in them. It seems like slugs have evolved multiple times, including sea slugs, which are unrelated to land slugs, but they are related to sea snails. So basically, there's this slug body shape that emerges multiple times from the snail family.
So you can't go back in any family trees far enough to find a point where sea snails or slugs and land snails or slugs converged?
Oh, they would have evolved, had a common ancestor originally, but the point is they were not like sea slugs did not come from land slugs.
Oh, yeah, righto.
What I'm saying, yeah. So this is an example of convergent evolution, which I'm sure you've all heard about. This is where different species evolve different features despite being kind of unrelated. So, for instance, you know, bats and birds have wings. I mean, that's how you fly, essentially. Yeah. But they have a similar kind of system for flying. A lot of things that live in the sea, like, you know, fish and dolphins, and if you look back in time to the time of dinosaurs, you had your ichthyosaurs, they all look very similar because there's a good shape for swimming in the sea. This kind of stuff. So you get this convergent evolution. It happens a lot. There's a famous example that was kind of became an internet meme, which was crabs. Have you heard of this?
Oh, that everything becomes a crab if you give them long enough?
That's the meme.
Yeah.
That's not how evolution works.
No, obviously not.
But it came out in, I think, about 2019. Basically, a study came out that showed that crabs have evolved from various forms of crustaceans five separate times. So there's the order Brachyura, which is known as true crabs. But then there are other orders that have evolved also this crab-like body shape. So essentially, we're talking about things that have come from like lobsters or prawns, those kind of things, things with big tails that can flick and swim quite quickly. Crab shape, they kind of got a flattened, rounded body shape. They've lost their tail. Well, they haven't lost their tail. It's tucked under the normally, but it's too small to do much swimming with. And they've got other strategies that they use. And like I said, this has evolved a few times. There's a lot of things that look like crabs that are called crabs but are not closely related. And this is a process that's been called carcinization, the fact that these things turn into crabs, which is a great name. There's also decarcinization because it's not a dead end. Like, so spanner crabs, for instance, I don't know if you've seen them. They're true crabs, but they are evolving a longer body shape because they live in the mud. So instead of like hiding under rocks as a lot of crabs, you know, normal crabs do, these ones are, you know, swimming around in sediment, and so they're kind of getting back their swimming shape.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So crab is, does that mean crab is a very beneficial shape to be in lots of different habitats? That's kind of what I take from
well,
that.
Well, in the aquatic habitat.
In the aquatic habitat.
Well, also land crab, like, you know, your coconut crabs and those sort of things, you know.
Christmas crabs, those kinds of things. Mm.
Huh. So, yeah, so that is carcinization. But there's also another more notable one recently published in the International Journal of Organic Evolution. They found this same phenomenon occurring in mammals with things that eat ants.
Oh, right.
I would call them anteaters, but anteaters are a specific thing. So let's call them myrmecophages, which is things that eat ants. Okay, so we can call myrmecophagization if you want to, instead of like the carcinization, we've got myrmecophagization. And now, so what these researchers did, basically, they looked at the diets of nearly 4,100 mammal species, mapped them onto their evolutionary history, and they found that in the last 66 million years, so basically this is since the dinosaurs died out, the end of the Cretaceous period, there have been 12 times at least that something has evolved to eat ants.
And ants, like ants solely? Just ants?
Well, specialised, because very specialised. We're talking about like long sticky tongues, you know, fewer teeth, good, you know, front legs for digging up.
Pangolins, echidnas,
anteaters. Yeah, so yeah, anteaters, okay, the obvious one. They are related to sloths. They live primarily in South America. You've got, pangolins, which are more like related to carnivores, like your dogs and cats and weasels and ferrets and things. There's aardvarks in Africa. They're more related to elephants. And there's, of course, Australia, so you have your echidnas, which are monotremes, and you have numbats, which are marsupials.
Oh, yes.
So it's happened all across, like, the mammal kind of
system.
I suppose.
Yeah. Mm.
And, yeah, it's a fairly common thing. Now, the reason for this is fairly obvious.
There's a lot of ants around?
There are a lot of ants around, yeah. Yep. And, like, ants really kind of exploded since the Cretaceous. Apparently they went from something like 1% of total insects to a combined 45%. This is for ants and termites. And you get huge colonies and this kind of thing. So if you can evolve the ability to eat ants, then you're on a winning track. Because there's a lot of them there, essentially.
And, I mean, if you don't mind the taste of formic acid, go for your life.
Well, they do speculate that, you know, how is this affected? Ant evolution, perhaps. Like, for instance, ants' defensive things are often against other insects and this kind of stuff. And now that they've got big mammals attacking them, they maybe have to develop new poisons, this kind of stuff, to defend themselves against larger mammals. But yeah, look, it's really interesting. It's happened a lot. So that's myrmecophagization. demyrmecophagization is rare, apparently. They only found one mammal group that has reversed course from anteating. These are the short-eared elephant shrews, and they think their ancestors were more, you know, anteaters. They're like elephant shrews. They're tiny little rat-like things, but they have like a proboscis, like a prehensile nose almost.
Wow.
And so the modern ones, they are more omnivorous. They eat insects and things like seeds and fruit and stuff like that. So they're not restricted to just insects. But their ancestors are believed to have eaten ants. So they're the only known example of someone giving up eating ants.
I guess the question is, why did they stop eating ants? It's, you know, unless you run out of ants, there's no real reason to stop eating ants.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, they're quite small, so maybe, I don't know.
They got attacked.
Yeah. But, you know, it's an interesting thing. So there's two studies, like crabs and anteaters have been quite successful, a lot of convergent evolution there. Maybe someone needs to do a similar study on sluggification. I'm not volunteering because, like I said, they're disgusting. I think that anyone's in a hurry to examine a slug evolution. But, like, it's interesting that you can see this, happening in with various kinds of creatures. And it is fascinating to see, this same body type appearing over and over again.
Don't want to get slugged with that research.
No.
That's all we have time for on another episode of Lost in Science. Thanks for listening. Lost in Science is recorded on the lands of the Kulin Nations and the Ngunnawal people and broadcast across Australia on the Community Radio Network with the kind support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. If you would like to get in touch with us, we would love to hear from you. You can drop us a line at lostinsci@gmail.com. You can find us on Facebook, where we are Lost in Science on 3CR. Or you can just tune in wherever you find us, on your radio, on your podcast, next week when Chris, Stu, Lyndon and Claire get Lost in Science.
Thanks for listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online.